This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, More God, Seeing the Blessings Through the Pain. And the authors are Nate Lytle with James H. Pence. And Nate joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to you by Westbow Press. Hello, Nate.
Hello. You doing all right, Steve?
Doing great, and it's an honor to have you with us. It's a great story, an incredible story of dedication to serving others and your faith in God that led you through this incredible experience. Let me read a couple of things you've written about your book. You say, this book will inspire you to value people more, increase or open your hearts to faith, and possibly give you a different outlook on life and direction. Well, this book is about you, your life, and of course, More God tells the compelling story of how God brought back Nate from the brink of death and put him in the very unique position of speaking truth into the lives of those who cannot speak for themselves. From a near-death experience to an amazing love story to a new direction in life, this book is destined to make you laugh, cry, and make you appreciate life. Well, that's a lot to deal with in one book, Nate, but this is your story, isn't it?
Yes, Steve. When I woke up from the coma, I wanted to just be able to give back as much as I could. Obviously, I couldn't have done any of this without the power of prayer, friends, and family. But I noticed that when I woke up from the coma, there's a lot of people that don't want to come back to a rehab hospital, you know, the place where they woke up from the coma. And I decided to use this struggle as an opportunity to serve. So for me, it just opened a new area of ministry and speak truth in people's lives, you know.
Well, we'll get into the details of what happened, but just briefly for everyone's information, back in 2007, Nate fell from the top of a 10-foot ladder, shattering his skull and leaving him with a severe brain injury. But let's go back. Let's go way back to when you were 15 years young, and you're a surfer. You're a dedicated surfer, aren't you?
Yes, Steve. I started surfing when I was about 14, 15 years old. In the Gulf here, and grew up in Corpus Christi, Victoria area, South Texas, always wanted a ride to the beach because I still couldn't drive. So the two people that showed me how to surf, actually there was about three of them, most of them were pastors at our church. So when you're in a car for 3 hours round trip to get to the beach to go surf, you don't have much of an opportunity to talk. It's more about listening, you know, all these pastors and good people just pouring life into me at a young age.
Well, there you were, sitting on your surfboard, just, I guess, trying to take in the beauty of the ocean and getting ready to do that when you saw some young boys just shouting at each other and something terrible happened. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, Steve, we were just, it was a normal day. I was still 14, 15 years old, and we were just catching waves over in Port Aransas, Texas. And I see these three boys, and they were really young. And, you know, like I said, I was still 14, 15 years old. They were less than probably 10 years old, around that age. They had a little brother, and the big brother was basically telling them, look, you got to jump off this pier and don't be afraid and stuff like that. And I had a big brother growing up, and my big brother would always tell me, if you don't do this, you know, I'm going to punch you in the arm or whatever kind of thing, you know. So that's basically what was going on with the big brother telling the little brother to jump on from the pier into the water. And so, you know, I felt what that little boy was thinking exactly. So I was watching this all unfold. Well, the big brother made the little boy jump from the pier. Pretty big jump. Pretty big jump. I'd say, 12 to 15 foot drop when the young boy jumped into the water. Apparently he didn't know how to swim, so it was really bad. So he's right next to the piling. He just holds on to the piling. He's just screaming, you know, the young boy. And I started paddling over there. Mind you, there's several other people in the water we were surfing with. And I guess people didn't really notice too much, but I watched the whole thing happen. I paddle up, and the kid is just screaming and crying, holding onto that piling well.
And he's pretty bloody too.
Oh yes, sir. Yes, Steve. What was going on is the waves just kept coming through the pilings to the pier, and the little boy just holding on by dear life, you know. And, well, those pilings are wrapped up in barnacles, so that stuff is so sharp.
It's cutting him all up. Yeah, cutting him all up.
There was blood everywhere. I'd never seen something like that. I was, like I said, 14, 15 years old, all that blood. But I knew, you know, I'd been searching for a while. I knew that, you know, it's going to get worse if he just holds on to it. So basically just, you know, I was trying to get him to chill out for a minute because he was just screaming and freaking out. And his brothers were up on top of the piers, just looking up here, just looking down. So I told the young boy, you know, just chill out. I'm going to paddle you into the pier, but you got to let go of the piling. And he was too scared. So I got off my surfboard, and I had a leash, you know, with basically like an anklet that attaches to the surfboard to your ankle. I put the leash around his ankle, and I basically got around him and pushed off the piling with my own foot, and because he was just stuck onto it like glue, you know, he was too scared to let it go. So finally got off the piling, and we got him on the surfboard. I said, look, you just got to slow your breathing, you know. He's going to pass out, you know.
All right. So you got him into shore. You got him into shore, and they revived him.
Yeah. You know, he never went out completely. He didn't pass out completely, but he was in that state where he was basically pretty much in shock.
You were a hero. You were a hero at 15 and pretty much on top of the world. But you say by 2007, you felt like surfing was a distraction from you listening to God.
Yes, I like I said, I grew up in the ministry with those pastors that showed me how to surf, and so my ministry basically started when I was about 14 and 15 years old, and so I went through the military when I was 18, got out when I was about 22 and a half, went back home and full-time ministry again, just volunteer, I didn't have a full piece about what God was calling me to do for my life, you know. Basically, I had an opportunity to go plant a church with two of the pastors in Florida over in the East Coast, and at that point, I started this prayer journal, just praying that God would use me, whatever it takes, to bring glory for Him to Him. I never knew what that was going to take when I prayed, God use me to bring glory to Him.
So you fell off this ladder, and you say you shattered your skull and you had severe brain injury. You weren't expected to live.
Right, Steve. When I fell, the reason it was so bad that it was just because when I fell, you know, I shattered my skull, but it didn't bust my scalp. I had a normal hat on at work, so you know, when I fell, I shattered my wrist and my skull, but nobody knew I'd hit my head, you know, if that makes sense. So my wrist was mangled. So they took me in to check out my wrist, and I was talking all funny, you know, I was basically about to pass out. They took me in for the check out the wrist, and then the doctor finally was like, you know, this should be worse. This has got to be worse than the wrist injury because he's talking crazy. So they do a CAT scan, and one thing to another, as you read through the story, through the book, is just the timing was perfect. They saw the shattered CAT scan. They saw my shattered skull, and they gave me 15 minutes to live when they found the problem.
And if you did survive, they said you'd never walk, talk, or communicate again.
Right, Steve. They said I'd be a vegetable at best.
So your buddies, your surfing buddies, just got everyone to pray for you.
Right, exactly. We have an online surf forum in the Gulf Coast called the L Ride, which means Z Ride. The scene before I sail was kind of rough. You know, it was kind of like surf only forum. You just talk about surf. People didn't really want to talk much about anything other than surf. And every once in a while, people would throw out prayer requests, things like that. Every once in a while. But other than that, it was pretty rough on the edges kind of scene. And when I fell, for some reason, everybody just hung on to this Pray for Nate thread that started June 4th, 2007 when I fell. And it turned out to be the longest thread ever in L-Ride history, about a 5-inch binder front and back when he printed it out.
Wow. Well, that's wonderful. And since then, you have a mission. You have a ministry. Tell us about it.
What we're doing now, Steve, after the brain injury, and that, yeah, obviously I had a couple of years of therapy and all that, because I didn't know how to relearn to walk and talk, all those things. So after about 2 years of therapy, God really put in my heart to give back in the ways of surf camps, people that have disabilities. In the summers, pretty much every other week in the summer, we have a different surf camp where people have disabilities, whether it's autism, Down syndrome. We do surf camps for the blind, which is a beautiful thing. We're working with an organization called Life Rolls On, and it's kids and adults that have spinal cord injuries. So pretty much anybody that wants to learn to surf, we can get them on a surfboard, and it's an awesome thing. So it brings a lot of peace and independence to people that have disabilities, because you're always limited to a wheelchair or to relying on other people to get you around. Well, when you're on your surfboard, they're on the surfboard, there's freedom and there's independence. You know, only if it's 15-second ride. You know.
Well, you thought you'd be in surfing competitions, and now you're in surfing service to help others. You just see good in every situation, and you also realize the power of prayer.
Totally, Steve. I realized that without prayer and without people in life, everything else is kind of like details now since the brain injury. I guess it's the near-death experience thing, maybe. If I didn't know that before, the power of prayer and people before I fell, God just reinforced it and had dirt. I'm able to go speak on a pretty much regular basis on weekends, doing book signings on Saturdays and speaking on Sundays at churches and benefits that people have brain injuries and strokes, speaking at hospitals and rehab hospitals. God just opened a huge door just giving back.
Well, you've come to know that as believers in Christ, God sometimes let us go through struggles and pain.
Yes, sir. I grew up hearing that from the two pastors that would take me to the beach all the time. Was God never wastes a hurt, and that was always ingrained in my head. Hearing that, And I guess I never had a whole lot of hard times physically or emotionally as a kid. And then it finally set in when I woke up from the coma. It's like, oh, God never wastes a hurt. And I've hung on to that. The way I've kind of used it is like I said, to use every struggle in life is an opportunity to serve.
Well, as one of your supporters said about you, Nate reminds us that a disabling accident or injury can be a new beginning. His words challenge us to take back our lives. The world depends on our contributions and to never bury our gifts or silence our voice. Well, you're a great example to all of us, Nate. Thank you so much. The name of his book, More God, Seeing the Blessings Through the Pain. Nate, tell us how to get your book.
Steve, the book is pretty much all over. You can order directly from my website at natelytle.com.
And that's Lytle is L-Y-T-L-E, natelytle.com.
Yes, sir. You can purchase directly on my website or it's Amazon, Barnes & Noble's. It's in Kindle, every format. It's out. You can see it purchased. So.
Nate Lytle, he is the author, More God, Seeing the Blessings Through the Pain. And this interview is brought to everyone by Westbow Press. Nate, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for all the listeners.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready to live La Bella Vita with Dawn Catherine on Toginet.com. Live La Bella Vita. If you're wanting to know all the beauty tricks of the trade and the latest fashion trends before everyone else, this is your show. If you admire celebrities' beauty and their fashion sense, this is your show. Do you love wine and want to know more about the process it takes to make wine from the vine to the bottle? This is your show. Live La Bella Vita. For more on the show and your host, check out our website, LaBellaVitaCosmetico.com. This is the kind of show you can sink your teeth into. If you enjoy traveling and food and family, all with an Italian flair, then you can live La Bella Vita with your host, Dawn Catherine. Wednesday nights at midnight, 11 p.m. Central on Toginet.com. Mark Lipinski is coming to Toginet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on Toginet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, It's Okay to Say God, Prelude to a Constitutional Renaissance. And the author is Tad Armstrong, and Tad joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to you by Westbow Press. Hello, Tad.
Hello.
Great to have you with us. This is going to stretch our minds and hopefully get our hearts beating a little faster, get the blood pumping, because you have some strong feelings about the Constitution and the way Christians look at it. You might take exception with some of the things that Christians believe, but we'll get into that in a moment.
Sure.
Let me just read a couple things you've written. If you don't know how your car works, it will not serve you well. If you don't know how your government works and your constitution, Self-government is doomed to fail you. If you care about the truth of the role of religion and government in this country and are tired of operating on fiction, you need to read It's Okay to Say God. Well, that's loaded. That little paragraph is loaded. Well, Tad, first of all, tell us about yourself and why you decided to publish this book.
Well, I've been practicing law for about 36 years in Illinois, about 7 years ago, I mentioned my frustration with our level of knowledge of our Constitution to a friend at a coffee shop, and he challenged me, frankly, to teach the nation. And golly, I took him up on it. We started a little club in Edwardsville, and now we have several around the area. And on this particular topic of the religion clauses of the First Amendment, we are so desperately in need of the knowledge of this to equip ourselves, especially as Christians, but as all American citizens, make sure that our government is operating correctly and to know this law. We cannot expect our government to operate as it is supposed to without knowledge.
Well, knowledge is power, and it's been the goal, I think, of these grassroots groups, the Tea Party groups, to learn. But a lot of people just kind of yell and scream and get their blood pressure up, but maybe don't spend the time learning. So here we're going to take some time, and hopefully you're going to teach us. I know you are. I wanted to just kind of jump in. Your chapter 2 says, "Our worst enemy is..." And then, of course, you don't say what it is. What is our worst enemy?
Well, of course, the worst enemy is Satan. But the purpose of my chapter on that particular topic was to suggest that a lot of really good-intending Christian folks are doing a great deal of damage to Christianity. And I know that sounds shocking, but I know this to be true. The title of my book came from an internet story that's gone around all over the country, no telling how many times now, about an elderly couple that visited the World War II Memorial who became dismayed and angry when they saw that "So Help Us God" was not engraved on the side of that memorial. And the older gentleman ends the story by saying, "That's right, I guess, we're not supposed to say things of God anymore." You see, that kind of thing lights my fire, because who said that? No Supreme Court justice has ever said that. No president has ever said that, to my knowledge. But people keep sending these things all over the nation and the world, and before you know it, as Vladimir Lenin said, a lie told often enough becomes the truth, and what we start operating in defeat. That is one serious problem. I can give you another example if you want one.
Please.
Just the other day before Christmas, a good friend of mine said to a judge uptown, "Judge, I know it's not politically correct, but nevertheless, Merry Christmas." Now, that's a well-intended Christian who thinks they're taking a stand for Christ. Listen, that speaks defeat. We don't need to issue a disclaimer when we greet someone with Merry Christmas. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So much of the problem of the cult, well, I found this statistic the other day, and I've spoken on this around the area. A poll showed that 76% of Americans claim to be Christians. The same poll showed that 9% of Americans put God first in their lives. Is there any wonder we have a culture problem in this nation?
Right.
We have got to get to the point where we, A, learn the law, that's very important, and B, we've got to take our faith to the streets. I think we need to be street smart. That's the way we're going to change the culture.
The wall of separation phrase, isn't it in the Constitution?
It is not.
A lot of people believe it.
A lot of people criticize Jefferson a great deal and the concept at all, And they're quick to stand up and suggest that, true, the wall of separation phrase is not in the Constitution. And but they go a step further. They seem to imply they want that wall torn down. Nothing could be worse for religion or Christianity if that were to occur. Listen, I don't want this government in my pulpit. You see what I'm saying? There needs to be a separation. Now, does it need to be a wall that's impenetrable and says to our nation that we can't even mention God in school or government? Absolutely not. That was never intended. I call it, if we're going to use a metaphor, I like to say a short fence is appropriate. The kind of thing that keeps your stuff out of my yard and my stuff out of your yard, but still permits us to be friendly across the fence.
So we have a real problem in this nation. Americans are constitutionally ignorant.
It sounds pretty harsh. You know, I don't mean that in a pejorative manner or a pejorative way. I mean it for what it's the definition of ignorance is a lack of knowledge. On our Constitution, you better believe we are. I doubt very many congressmen have a good grasp of it. Some do, but this is a serious problem in our country.
Why have the courts taken the Pledge of Allegiance out of public schools?
You know, most people believe that. If you're a parent of a child in public school and you're staying on top of your kid's education, you would know that that is not true. But most people on the street believe it is, and that's another part of the problem. One time only, the Ninth Circuit in California struck the Pledge of Allegiance from the schools because of the under God phrase. An atheist pursued that lawsuit, but that was reversed in the Supreme Court on appeal due to a technicality. They didn't address the actual issue, but nevertheless, it's been tried by atheists about 8 more times around the country, and all 8 courts of appeal have nipped that challenge in the bud, and it is perfectly legal to have the Pledge of Allegiance in our schools. But I get emails all the time from well-intending, good Christians saying to me, isn't it a shame the Supreme Court of these United States have taken the Pledge of Allegiance out of schools? That is just false. And I can say again, keep saying it, before you know it, it'll happen. You know, there's one other aspect to the pledge, though, that ought to be noted. In the 40s, Jehovah's Witnesses challenged the pledge because it was their belief that pledging allegiance to a flag is the worship of a graven image and a sin. I kind of get that. And the Supreme Court, in a wonderful decision, West Virginia versus Barnett, said, you know, eventually they reversed a prior case, but they said, you know, you're right. Our Constitution does not permit government to suggest that you cannot freely exercise your religion by forcing you to say that on the penalty of being expelled from school or fining your parents. And they made an exception for those of faith that believed it was the worship of a graven image, not to participate. It was a good decision.
Teachers believe that God, mentioning God or the Creator in class, they can't do that? Do they believe
you know,
that?
Some of them do. That seems to be another myth that a lot of people believe. And this won't take me long. I'd like to read you a quote from the Supreme Court opinion, Van Orden versus Perry, issued in 2005. This is what people are not aware of. It says, words like God are not vulgarities for which the shock value diminishes with each successive utterance. The wall that separates the church from the state does not prohibit the government from acknowledging the religious beliefs and practices of the American people, nor does it require governments to hide works of art or historic memorabilia from public view just because they also have religious significance. And here's the key sentence here. The state may provide its school children and adult citizens with educational materials that explain the important role that our forebears' faith in God played in their decisions to select America as a refuge from religious persecution, etc. That's the Supreme Court of the United States. I think many people, many Christians, would be surprised at that language.
Right, right. Well, and also, your book addresses those on the right who believe government should sponsor nativity scenes, prayer in public elementary schools, and the Ten Commandments in public schools.
You know, I probably don't have time to talk about all of those, but one of my pet peeves is I have a chapter on symbols that deal with these cases concerning nativity scenes and symbols of other beliefs and faiths. This is the worst victory for Christianity there could be. It is definitely a Pyrrhic victory. When the Christians in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, fought for and won the right to have the government involved with a nativity scene at Christmas. I know that might shock some, but let me tell you the outcome of this. Ultimately, that was upheld. Many of the reasons the Supreme Court upheld that nativity scene will be shocking to most Christians. Justice O'Connor says, after all, it doesn't mean what it used to mean. This is merely a way to draw people downtown to spend their money at Christmas. It's a commercial.
Oh, my goodness.
Number one. Number two, many of the justices permitted it to stand because it was shabby. It only took $20 to maintain. It was it didn't glorify God, let's put it that way, in the sense of there's certainly no gold, frankincense and myrrh at the altar, okay? But there was a lot of Santa Claus and toys around it in the area. In other words, they let this thing stand because it just, in their opinion, doesn't have the religious significance it used to. I think that's a slap in the face to Christianity. After that decision, another case came up in Pittsburgh in the Supreme Court. And for the very same reasons, this was a really nice nativity scene at the county courthouse. It was struck down because it sent too much of a message of the meaning of Christ's birth. But the menorah down the street at the county building was allowed to stand. This is the kind of religious warfare that the Constitution is designed to prevent in this nation where we're free. And what it has done is this. Every time we approach Christmas, we have these fights all over the country. Good people fighting for their nativity scene. And let me tell you something. What that has done is it has won the right of atheists and all other faiths, some of which compete with Christianity, for their 100 square feet of turf at the courthouse as well. You cannot grant that right to one faith and deny it to others. That would absolutely be wrong, and that's been the ruling around the country. So now, every time we approach Christmas, we're not celebrating Christ's birth near as much as fighting over who gets turf at the courthouse. And what I say in my book is, and I don't have all the answers, that's why at the end of every chapter I provide what I call suggested Christian responses. And my response to these symbol cases is this. I would much rather see Christ win than Christianity. In other words, at Christmas, Christians ought to be teaching their children about Christ and his birth and what it means. They ought to be de-emphasizing toys and emphasizing Christ and going to a soup kitchen and sending something to a military person on the battlefield and taking serious time out to spread Christ. To spread the faith of Christianity and Christ's message to the world. When we fight with other religions on who gets what turf, and when, we lose because we win for atheists and all other faiths as well. And I'm telling you something. In 2009, Bill O'Reilly, Fox News, I like Bill, watch a lot of Fox News. He literally spent 2 or 3 weeks on television reading the Atheist Creed in Seattle every night because he thought it should be excluded. The governor permitted the nativity scene and the Atheist Creed. She had to do that. And what is the result? Atheism got free publicity to the world for 3 weeks in advance of Christmas, I don't call that a victory for Christ.
Interesting.
See what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes. Well, you spent some time writing a 3,000-page treatise on the Constitution. That must have been quite an experience.
Well, it was. I didn't start out this journey intending to do that, but I found that I could not stay away from it. And so with these clubs I've got around, it wound up being about 3,000-page treatise with commentary. And we've had clubs all around the Metro East, St. Louis Metro East area for the last 7 years. I'm going to turn that into a DVD program that I'm going to try to plant a seed on with my book around the country. I intend to start a lecture tour called Taking It to the Streets Smart about our faith and the law, and hopefully plant a seed that we'll be providing a DVD course on the Constitution from the Christian perspective in the very near future. I'm very anxious to get that started.
The title of the book, It's Okay to Say God, Prelude to a Constitutional Renaissance, and the author is Tad Armstrong. Tad, tell us how to get your book.
Well, you can get it on my website, which is ellconstitutionclubs.com. That's pretty lengthy. The ELL stands for Earn It, Learn It, or Lose It, but ellconstitutionclubs.com. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble online, Westbow Press online, and eventually we're going to get this in stores all across the country, I'm confident.
Thank you, Tad, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to everyone by Westbow Press. Thanks a lot, Tad.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Want to be challenged in a powerful way to leap beyond what you think is possible? Then join us Mondays for the Leah Jansen Show, every Monday at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com with Leah Jansen. Listen live as life coach Leah uses her coaching skills to give you the tools you need to take action and create momentum. You are encouraged to call in and share your greatest fears, challenges, and obstacles, and then listen as Leah obliterates those barriers to success. For more on Leah and the show, check out her website, leahjansen.com. That's Leah, LEAHJANTZEN.com. Spend 1 hour with Leah, and you'll be captivated by her energy, enthusiasm, and magnetism. You'll quickly become addicted to her positive attitude and make-it-happen mentality. Ready for a life-changing, mood-altering show? Then get ready for Leah Jansen and listen live to The Leah Jansen Show every Monday morning at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com.
People think I've made it. I'm popular. I seem happy all the time. I have great clothes and I'm involved in everything. But I have questions, doubts, and fears, just like every other teenager. That's why I'm glad for Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
The choices we have to make that can alter the course of our lives. Life is too much pressure if we try to go it alone. I tune in to Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell every week to get reminded that I'm not alone. Nicole Odell is an expert on what happens in the lives of teenagers. Join her as she deals with topics like peer pressure, purity, drugs, alcohol, and many other things that might come up along the way. She writes books and speaks to people all over the place, but she says her favorite moments are when she can pull up a chair and chat with teens about what's important to us.
For more information on Nicole and her books, go to NicoleOdell.com. Then join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Supreme Sacrifice, A Woman's Journey from the Bondage of Guilt to the Freedom of Forgiveness. And the author is Rita Maley. And Rita joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Rita.
Hello, Steve. Nice to talk to you this afternoon.
Well, great to have you with us. You're really going to take us on quite a journey, a real story based on true events, true experiences in your life. You say this: what if your father died in a mysterious car crash before you resolved your complicated family relationship, and only by moving from the industrial city of your birth to start over in the deep South were you able to unlock the answers to his death? In Supreme Sacrifice, that's just what April Straka is facing as she sets off on a compelling journey of self-discovery. And of course, in this case, this father is also an alcoholic. That poses a whole, or creates a whole different spin on a story, a true story, or at least based on true experiences. But you've kind of changed the names to protect the innocent. Is that what we've done here?
Well, I would like to clarify, it's not a memoir or a biography. It's in writing what we call a semi-autobiographical novel.
All right.
And what that means is it draws heavily on experiences of the author's life for its plot, to protect either the privacy of the family, friends, or loved ones,
sure,
to achieve emotional distance, or for artistic reasons. I think that was more mine, because it allows you to simplify the plot lines, your themes, other details.
But often, as we know, fiction also is often created based on experiences.
Absolutely, absolutely. So just so that the listeners know that it is inspired by true events, but not a memoir.
Okay. Very good. Okay. I'm glad you clarified that. Now, the motivation to write the book, there's got to be some pain here when you do something like this.
Well, yes, but it's, you know, you're seeing it from years later at a distance, so it's not as painful, but maybe more cathartic.
Mm-hmm.
And for the time it took me to write it, it just became clear that I hope that I would be able to inspire readers, that it's how you bounce back from your lowest point in life that makes you what you are. And, you know, this suffering can eventually lead a person to positive change, growth, and even strength. It certainly made me stronger, and success. So even if you've grown up in an alcoholic home, as I have, with continuous disappointment, we still have choices. Some of us go into therapy. Some of us suppress bad memories from the past. Many of us follow in our parents' footsteps and repeat their mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But my choice was, I wanted to write it down to offer encouragement to others who might have traveled a similar path in their childhood, in hopes that my story might be a guidepost or a testament to the fact that no matter how we sometimes screw up our lives, the spirit to heal and the struggle that continues a family never really quits.
There's always hope.
Yeah, absolutely there is. And we learn from all of these struggles.
Right. Now, young April, tell us about her.
Young April was brought to the depths of despair, first by her father's alcoholism, and then to his tragic, mysterious death. She was young when he died. I don't want to go into too much description of what transpired.
Sure.
The last time they saw each other before he passed away. But it's a journey that she's taken. It spans three decades in her life. So it starts out in her early 20s, starts out in the 60s, and ends up in the early 90s. So it shows one of the things that is different about this book than other books with alcoholism. It shows how long it takes to heal from this disease in the family. And in this case, it was three decades it took her to really understand what was this all about, his mysterious accident, his abrupt death. So she loves her father, but hates his alcoholism, and that's not unusual. And later in life, he actually metaphorically becomes split in two, because her son, as he when he was born, as he gets older, he embodies a lot of her father's good qualities and even resembles him in looks. But then she meets somebody in Florida later in life who embodies her father's destructive behavior, and that turns her back into the terrified child she once was. But there is an answer by the end of the book.
Well, that's great. There's always hope, as you pointed out, in the worst of circumstances, though I'm sure sometimes people would say, no hope for me.
Absolutely, there's hope. And you have to learn along the way, as I have learned. You have to learn about forgiveness. You have to learn to take some risks. Learn how to change. You don't change what's happened, but you change how you see what happens. So, you know, nobody can go back and start a new beginning, but anyone can start today and make a new ending. So, and that's the key. We can change our life, and there is hope.
So we need to continue the struggle. You say the struggle for independence and freedom, and at the same time, you've got to have dreams.
Absolutely, dreams. Yes, and dreams were probably one of the most important things in the book. There were two instances with dreams with April. She experienced nightmares after her father's death, and the other time was later on in life during midlife, her midlife crisis. And, you know, dreams can be an outlet, an escape valve for all the negativity we hold in our conscious mind. So these dreams were very representative of what was going on subconsciously with her. And I don't, again, I don't want to reveal too much, but I just want to explain that dreams, whatever you dream about, it's never in the dream, it's outside the dream. And they help us with realities, to deal with them in an unconscious state when it's so hurtful that our conscious mind can't handle it. So they can be very healing, and our memories are held in our subconscious, and the key to unlock those sometimes is through our dreams. There was a movie, and I reference it in the book, A Dead Poets Society, and they talk about dreams, and there was something that a saying that really rang very true, only in dreams can men be truly free, was always thus and always thus will be. So that was, was probably the scenes that were highlighted the most in the book, are these two dreams that were actually nightmares, but they really weren't once she understood what they were all about.
And these themes in your book, these dreams also require taking risks.
Absolutely.
That's tough.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Those can be walls that people can't get over or get around.
Because you have to surrender to the unknown when you're taking a risk. Yes, I agree.
That's a scary phrase right there. Surrender to the unknown.
Yes. Well, and that's what we have to do sometimes, is take risks.
Right.
I don't know, many people, millions of people have read Who Moved My Cheese, and that's all about a simple way to explain how powerful it can be if you're willing to take the risk and find out what's around the corner. But so many people will rather stay with what they know, even though it's not happy, rather than taking the risk to the unknown.
And of course, that future, that dream, as you point out, it's important, essential to struggle to stay in the present without wallowing in the past. It's so easy, I guess, just to kind of fall back in it and say, I can't do it, probably. This is too much.
Right, right. Exactly. And, you know, we have to have, there are some themes in the book that we talk about, like limitations. We're often told, you know, to know our limitations. But what are our limitations? The truth is, it's what we have in our minds and our beliefs. So, you know, whether you think you can do something or you can't, you're right. I think Henry Ford said that. And that is so true. And I tell my granddaughters that, you know, you have the power to do whatever you want. It's what you think about, the words you use. Those are the things. Whether you think you can or you can't, right. You're right.
That's self-talk.
Yes, exactly.
Well, your book is certainly relevant today. You say that one in four children has a parent who is an alcoholic or has some kind of an addiction.
1 in 4, yes.
34
under the
million.
Age of 18 is okay. Hurt by family alcohol abuse.
34 million children.
10.5% of American families are affected by alcohol. So, I mean, we're talking, this is, and it's not getting any better. Probably, right. You know, there's so many commercials and, you know, just the Super Bowl. How many of our commercials were about alcohol? So it can be, it has hurt many families.
Right.
Yes.
Self-medicate.
Yes, exactly.
So we're trying to help people see that you can overcome fear.
Yes, you can. Fear binds the world, and forgiveness is what sets it free. And so many times the forgiveness is not necessarily with forgiving other people, but many times it's forgiving yourself. And when you forgive, you call upon the strength of the Spirit within you, and you release all that darkness and fear. It's actually the method to transform fear to love. And April's nightmares were based in repressed guilt and fear. And it can do a lot of harm if we don't learn what's going on and forgiving ourselves.
And the best way to change the world is by changing how we see it.
Exactly.
I'm saying that's one of your key messages.
It is. Whether you think you can or you can't, you're right. Whatever you focus on, whether it's right or wrong, will be what we receive more of. I mean, you never have to change what you see, only the way you see it. We're responsible for what we see. We choose the feelings we experience. You know, if we want to, you know, if we, you hear so many times people are pessimistic. They always see the glass as half empty. Well, if they see the glass as half empty, their life will be half empty versus the person who is optimistic. The power is in us. We receive what we ask for. Again, as I mentioned, we can't go back and start a new beginning, but we can start today and make a new ending. And it's up to us. It's up to us.
Right. The past is gone. The future is what we're living or going to be living in. In fact, every moment, I guess, is the future.
Yes.
In some ways.
Yes.
You know, it's how we approach that. One of your reviewers said this, Rita takes the reader through a garden of life choked with the weeds of addiction, guilt, and blame. She shows we can turn that overgrowth back into a place of beauty and forgiveness. This is a valuable book to all of us who want to cultivate understanding and peace in our lives. That is so beautifully said.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I was introduced to some spiritual friends and some spiritual tools that changed my life and was able to turn back and to understand what was going on in my past, and being able to live such a wonderful, fruitful, positive life through all of this spiritual awakening and healing, because it is very healing.
Rita, give us a concluding thought.
Well, I think it's very timely. This is the end or February. February every year on Valentine's Week is the celebration of Children of Alcoholics Week. And this year, it's February 12th to the 18th. And I'd like to talk about it because it is so important. It's produced by the National Association of Broadcasters with the help from the National Association of Children of Alcoholics. It is celebrated to help break the silence often surrounding familial alcoholism and drug addiction, and to reach out to support these children and their families. You know, the most insidious thing with alcoholism is the silence. Families keep it quiet. And one of the things on the Dr. Phil, if people, so many millions, watch the Dr. Phil show, you can't change what you don't acknowledge. So the longer you keep this silent, denial is the greatest ally that alcoholism has, and it's the biggest enemy that you have to combat. And to spend energy denying what is real is to take the energy away from other things that can be more beneficial, like getting well. And I applaud the National Association of Broadcasters and the Association of Children of Alcoholics, because it is mostly, it's helping each year to help break that silence surrounding family alcoholism. And I know from my life how important it is. So I would just like people to acknowledge it, and hopefully you'll be seeing more this next week about that celebration.
The title of the book, Supreme Sacrifice, A Woman's Journey from the Bondage of Guilt to the Freedom of Forgiveness. And the author is Rita Maley. And Rita, tell us how to get your book.
You can get my book either through my publisher, which is BalboaPress.com. You can get it from my website, which is RitaMaley.com. You can get it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the book is either ebook or soft cover.
Rita, we thank you so much for being with us on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Thank you, Rita.
And thank you, Steve.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.